Accession number 19598, Reel 2.
Don Featherstone, Reel 2.
Yeah. Well, they decided to start leave to England in late October, early November 1944, and we had 7 vacancies in my regiment, and quite rightly they gave first 5 to guys who'd won medals, and the last 2 they drew for, and I was the first one out the hat. On a Sunday morning they drew it, and I was the first one out the hat, and we were going on the 21st of November. Well, the 20th of November is Cambrai Day, Tank Regiment's day of the year. And you always traditionally play a six-a-side football game, which we did. We played against the officers and all that sort of thing. And I played in goal, I remember, for my squadron. And everybody saying, "You're raving mad, you might break your leg," and all that sort of thing. Anyway, that was the last game of football I ever played. And I came to England. We got a train down from Forley, Rimini, down that way, down to Naples. And then we came over on the, I think it was the Worcestershire Abibi Line boat, and came to Liverpool. And I had a month in England. My mother was there. My brother was abroad. He was overseas in Ceylon, and I had a month's leave there. During which time, I met my wife at a dance. I met her and her friend, and I went out with the friend kept in touch with her while I was overseas. I was very fond of her. When I got back to be demobbed 18 months, 2 years later, the friend and I fell out, and I started taking Joy, my wife, out to see what the friend was up to, and realised that Joy was the better one of the two. And we eventually got engaged and got married. And Sylvia, the first girl, was Joy's matron of honour. And Sylvia got married, and 9 months later, Sylvia died of a tumour of the brain at 23. So if I'd have married Sylvia, I would have been a widower inside a year. And that's the sort of luck that I've been blessed with in my life. I've had so much luck, really. I've had a lucky life. The only bad luck I've had was my son being killed on his motorbike in the police. Anyway, we came back to England, and I went back to the unit, and by that time they'd pulled back to Viterbo, an airfield outside Rome, and they were re-equipped with Churchill flamethrowing tanks. And we went back up about April 45, went back up forward, and the Germans were entrenched across the River Senio. And we put the flame-throwing tanks in across the Senio and flamed the German entrenchments and broke the way through for the rest of the forces to go through, the infantry and the lighter tanks to go through. And we just followed the Germans up. We flamed them at the Argenta Gap, I remember, one of our B squadron did. And we just sort of followed a fleeing enemy. And then we got through to near Padua, up in the north of Italy there, Ferrara, Padua. And we knew that was going to be the armistice at 11 o'clock that morning. And I remember going out of the orderly room area, and I stood on a ridge, and I looked back down Italy, southern Italy. It was spread out in front of me, right like a big map as I stood up there. And I looked at my watch, and it was 11 o'clock. And I remember I raised my arms up and I shouted out, "I'm alive! I've got through! I'm still here!" And it was just as if a great heavy pack had fallen off my back. And I stayed with the regiment. We sort of pottered around and did things, and we were being broken up because the regiment, they were very expensive to use, the tanks. They were broken up there. And in the July of 45, I was sent back to Naples to the second echelon, which was the army sort of headquarters back in Naples there. And I was rather singular and lucky in that I was a very accomplished shorthand typist. And I could take notes from anything at a drop of the hat. I could take shorthand notes and I could type them out and everything like that, which made me very valuable to people. I used to sit in on conferences and things with our commanding officer, and that was one of the reasons why I was sort of nurtured and cherished in the regiment, because I was the only bloke who could do it. And I wasn't a good soldier. I just did what I was told, and I just did my best. And that's about all you can do in that. And I got back to the Naples area, and we were a place called Caserta, where the Royal Palace was, and which was where the headquarters was. And we were billeted in a village called Madaloni, and I was in a bar in a hotel about 6 months ago, where I go to lunch with my Rotary Club, and the guy behind the bar was a foreigner, and I said, "So where do you come from?" "Oh, I come from Italy." So I said, "What part?" "Oh, near Naples." So I said, "Where near Naples?" "Oh, you wouldn't know it." I said, "Well, try me." So he said, I said, "I know Naples. I was in Caserta." "Oh," he said, "yes, Caserta, that is near where I live." I said, "I was billeted in Madaloni." "Madaloni," he said, "this is my village." So every time he served on table after that, I astonished all my friends by saying things like, "Come state, bene voi, non ci male," and going on with a little patter like that and everything. But I stayed there until I used to go into Naples, and I wasn't serious with you or anything. Well, then I hadn't really known I was going to do anything, and I had a girlfriend there called Batch, who was a sergeant in the ATS in the Royal Palace in Naples, and the officer there was always trying to get us to get married. He said, "You can get married in the same chapel that Nelson used to go to with Lady Hamilton," and all that sort of thing. And so I ambled all around Naples for a few months, and in January 46, I was 25 release group, very low release group for my age, because I'd been in a long time. And I got sent back to England and demobbed. And I remember an old sergeant in the sergeant's mess at Caserta. He said once, we were all moaning about being demobbed, and he was an old grenadier, and he said, been in the First War, he said, "You might not believe me," he said, "but the loneliest week of your life will be the week you get demobbed." And we all laughed, "Go on, can't get away from you all quick enough." You know, well, when I got home, and I got home to Paddington, where I live there, and I'd been away 6.5 years, and just my mother, my brother was still abroad. And for the first week, it was terrible. I didn't know anybody. I couldn't, had to sort of find my feet and everything. And I decided, I didn't quite know what I was going to do, really, but I'd done a lot of, I'd had a lot of massage as a racing cyclist. And I thought to myself, if I could learn to do a bit of massage, I could massage cyclists' hairy legs in the evenings, Friday evenings, for half a crown a time, which is like I used to have. So they used to give, they had a system of giving you a grant to help you with a career when you were demobbed. So I put in to be a masseur, and they said, "There's no such thing as masseur, you've got to be a physiotherapist." Well, I didn't know what a physiotherapist meant, the word meant. And they said, "You've got to prove the war interrupted your career." Well, I couldn't do that, so I lined up a job as a Gaumont British cinema manager at £8 a week. And I fancied standing there in the front in evening dress saying, "Did you enjoy it, madam?" And I was in a pub in Notting Hill Gate one night, a bit pickled, and a girl in the group I was with said, "I think it's disgraceful. You want to be a physiotherapist and they won't give you a grant." So I said, "So do I." So I went home. And in the wee small hours, I wrote a letter of appeal to the Ministry of Labour. And in due course, I had to go up to Ministry of Labour, Tavistock House, Tavistock Square, and for the appeal. And I, room 501, fifth floor, banged on the door, "Come in." I went in. There's a man sitting at a desk, bent over writing. And as I got to the front of the desk, I stood there. And he looked up and I looked down. And we both noticed each one was wearing a brown, red and green tie of the Royal Tank Regiment. "Through mud and blood to the green fields beyond the brown, red and green." So he said to me, "Were you in the Royal Tank Regiment?" I said, "Yeah, were you?" "Of course I was." He said, "I was in the 8th. So I said, "Oh, you know Tom Willett then." He got posted. "Of course I know Tom Willett." He said, "Sit down." So we sat down and we talked for about an hour. And he said, "What are you here for?" So I said, "I want to be a physiotherapist." He said, "What's stopping you?" I said, "You are." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I wouldn't stop anyone of the old regiment doing anything." So I said, "You won't give me a grant." He said, "You'll have it tomorrow." So within a couple of days, I had £2.17 and threepence a week. And I lived in post-war London on that for 3 years while I was at medical school. And then I...
What about this shell shock or bomb happiness? Did you completely recover from it?
Oh, when I got back after I'd been in London, you know, and in England for my leave, I took a while settling down again. I had a job getting to grips, but... No, I wasn't bomb happy then. I'd got rid of that, and I was just my normal, careful self. See, I went through the war never volunteering for anything particularly. I never went along any tracks that somebody else hadn't gone along first. I never opened doors or looked for loot or anything. And never sound outside toilet seats until I tested them. Because everything was booby-trapped. You see, we were always charged with going after a retreating enemy, and he was booby-trapping everything. And I've just been lucky. I can tell you, I could go on for hours telling you stories of guys I know who got blown up in booby traps and whose vehicles ran over mines and that. I was just lucky.
Tell me some of the examples of comrades that you lost in that way.
Well, I was thinking of this the other day. We had two very nice officers in my regiment, very nice young captains. And one was named John Ward, and the other one, I don't know his Christian name, but his initials were John Watts was one, and the other was C.T.J.F. Ward. Now, we had in our regiment a guy called Hare, Major Hare, who before the war had been a regimental sergeant major and was very tough. And I remember thinking once, if I was under you, I'd be more frightened. Actually, under you, I would be more frightened than I would be if I was facing the Germans, more frightened of him. Anyway, he was so brave, this bloke Hare, that when we were in England, he's dead now, he was at Security Corps in London for a long time. This guy Hare, when we were in England at Worthing, he used to spend his off-duty time going down to New Haven and bumming a ride on E-boats and strapping himself in an Oerlikon gun and going over the channel shooting up anything German they came across. And he lost an eye doing that, but he managed to get overseas with us. Well, on this particular night, this was moving up Italy, somewhere north of Rome. On this particular night, I'd got a little two-man tent, a little two-man bivvy, and I'd fixed it up about 10 yards to one side of a track where we had all the vehicles and we were harboured. And Hare took Ward and Watts out to another nearby regiment to the mess for the night. And they came back about midnight, and they came down this track where the Germans had buried telemines in the track deep enough so that after a few vehicles ran over it and knocked some of the topsoil off, they would set the mine off. And there was one of these mines just level with where I was laying in this tent, about 10 yards away. And this jeep went over it. And John Watts and CTJF Ward were both killed, and Hare was badly wounded. And I was lying there sort of on my bedding, so I was half asleep and that, and then this great explosion, and the tent and me and everything were flung through the air to one side. And so that was one of the things. And we had another instance where we were, there was this house, and the guys reckoned that there was something in there, and they were waiting to go in. And before they could go in, a vehicle came up with some Yanks in it, a Jeep. And they said, asked them what we're doing. We told them. They said, oh, come on, we'll be all right. So they went up, and they got a long pole, and they stood on the bottom of the steps, and they pushed the front door open with a pole. And as they pushed it, they turned around and ran. And we didn't do it. We watched them turn down and ran and jumped in a ditch. Well, nothing happened when the door opened, but the Jerry's had left some anti-personnel mines in the ditch, so they got blown up in the ditch. Yes, there were always other things happen. I remember my luck. I remember being at Bovington, and we were all supposed to go down to Salisbury Plain to watch a demonstration of Hurricanes shooting up tanks. And everybody went down there, and I didn't go, I was on duty. And everybody went down there, a big guy called Travers and an expert to me went. And they all went down there, and they were all sitting on this ridge and in these seats along these sort of grandstands. And these Hurricanes came over and shot up these tank, old tanks there, which were stuck out about 200 or 300 yards in front of all the people there. And one Hurricane mistook the place and shot the crowd up, and a lot of people were killed then. And this guy Travers was shot, was killed the next bed to me. And that was one thing. Then another thing happened. We in North Africa after the war finished there. We had a party, went up Longstrop Hill to have a look at it. And I wasn't on that party there again. And they walked into a minefield. And our Brigadier Naismith was killed. And all sorts of officers and people were killed on the going up there. And I could so easily have been with them. As I say, you know, some sort of personages. I haven't got a lot of faith, I'm afraid, in religions, not since my son was killed, but somebody's looked after me, certainly.
You were telling me earlier, off the record, about after Hollands lost his leg. Yeah. Was he Holland or Hollands with an S?
Gin Hollands. They call him Gin. Gin Hollands, because of Hollands Gin. After he lost his leg, and what he told me... Yeah. Well, he used to come to the dinner, as I said, every year. And about 15 years after the war finished, he and I were sitting there one night at this dinner. And it may have been, I think it was after the dinner. I think we'd both had a few drinks and we were a bit conversational. And he said to me, "You know, Don," he said, "when I came round in hospital and found I'd lost my leg," he said, "I thank God." I said, "Thank God, whatever for, Jim?" Well, he said, "You all expected so much of me in the regiment. I got a DSO and a DCM." He got a DCM as a sergeant, got promoted, commissioned in the field at Dunkirk Way, before Dunkirk. And he said, "You expected so much of me. I knew I was going to lose my nerve and do something silly," he said, and get a lot of my lads killed. So he said, "I was glad when I got taken away from them." Well, when he got discharged in the army, he went back to the police. He was an ordinary policeman, went back to the police in Bath. And the sergeant over him hadn't been in the army. And the chief constable of Bath was an ex-Royal Tank Regiment man. And this sergeant feared that Gin Hollands, with his record, would get preferential treatment because of that, you see. So there's Gin, an ex-major, squadron leader, DSO, DCM, ordinary constable, underneath this sergeant who gave him a terrible time until circumstances altered things, whatever they were.
What did you think of the leadership in the 51st Royal Tank Regiment?
I wouldn't criticise it. Colonel Timmis, Cecil Timmis, who was our CO up to most of the North African campaign, I stood by his grave in Tidworth Cemetery a few years ago, one morning there. And Colonel Timmis, if I had to go back through my life and find one person I think I respected and admired more than anybody else I've ever met, it would be Colonel Timmis. And I wrote and told this to his wife and his son when he died. And he was a wonderful bloke, and he was very good. Now, the guy who took over from him, as I told you, they were a Leeds Territorial Regiment. And all the officers and everybody knew each other, you see. They were all bank managers and all that. Well, the second in command was a guy called Holden, who was a solicitor in Leeds. Now, Holden was a weirdo. He was a tall man in the tank regiment who always wore riding boots and carried a riding crop and slapped his leg with it all the time. And he had a great big drooping moustache either side of his mouth there and glasses. And he was a complete antithesis of Timmis. I remember hearing him say once, where we came to a harbour, and there was a big house there, and I heard him say to the adjutant, "Well, we'll take the house over for the officers' mess, and the men can pig in around us." And I didn't have a lot of respect for him. He didn't like me. I was a southerner, and I was fairly prominent in the regiment because I edited a little regimental magazine. I've always done writing all my life, and when we had any theatricals, I used to do little monologues I'd written and all that sort of thing. And he didn't like me very much. I wasn't officer material. I would never have ever made an officer. And yet, funnily enough, since the war, I've hobnobbed. I know two field marshals who call me Don. And I've hobnobbed with officers, right, and they're well-known ones too, and got on very, very well with them. But I wouldn't have made an officer. I hadn't got what it took. And he was a different character. And he came home after the war, and on the very first dinner we had in Leeds, of course everybody was there, all the officers, he was there in the chair. And after we'd finished the meal, He was heard to say to the officers, "Come on, gentlemen, you come with me. I have a room downstairs reserved for the officers." Yes, at a regimental dinner when we were all civilians. And Gin Hollands wouldn't go, I remember. He stayed with us, upstairs with us. And this guy, Holden, went to Capri with his wife on holiday and was walking along the cliffs with her, and he said, "Goodbye, dear," and jumped off. My own squadron leader was Gordon Bradley, who lives in the Isle of Man, who was a great personal friend of mine now. At the time, he was during the war, he gave me a hard time, because he said to me once, he said, "All you effing southerners have swore a good regiment." And he denies saying it now, but he did. And he's lost his wife recently, and I ring him a lot and talk to him. And he's 86. He was a good man. He did his best. He was a good soldier. He admits now that he made a lot of mistakes, but he did his best. All the young officers were good. They were all brave, and they were rather like the young officers you see in World War I films and that, you know. They were jolly and together, and they sort of got drunk and had their little messes wherever they were. And one officer I remember was in command of a squadron. He's dead now, so I won't mention his name. In command of a squadron, and in North Africa, he took this squadron, went forward with them, and got himself stuck on a minefield under fire. And he panicked and rallied the squadron on him, and they all came and rallied on him on the minefield. So there was him and 11 other tanks all blown up. And this guy, Jock Hare, I was telling you about, who was lost his eye in an E-boat thing, he refused to go, and he was the only tank commander, the only tank in the squadron that wasn't blown up. And this officer, this major, was captured and was taken back to Tunis. Well, when Tunis fell, about 3 weeks later, he was released, you see, and he came back to the regiment and was sent to England on a staff course. Well, he returned to the regiment on the day we did the Hitler Line attack in Italy. And I got a message in the order room that this major was in Naples and wanted transport. So I hadn't got time to worry about him. We were much too busy with the attack going in. So we did nothing. And he arrived the following day. Well, the CO, Ronnie Holden, who I told you about, who was a nutter, was he and this officer had been to school together and everything in Leeds. They were bosom friends. They knew each other. This officer was this other major was a bank manager in Leeds. And into the orderly room comes the adjutant with a sheet of paper from the CO. And he says, this is a citation. So I said, "Who's it for, sir?" He said, "It's for," and it was this major. And Holden had recommended this major for a DSO, and he hadn't even been in the Hitler Line battle. He didn't come back till the day it took place, or the day after it took place. And I said, "I'm sorry, sir, but I can't type this." This is to Arthur Simmons, who, as I say, he's at Faversham. And he said, "You've got to, it's an order." I said, "I'm sorry, but I'm not typing it." So he typed it, and this man got a DSO, you see. Well, years after the war, I was at a regimental dinner, and one of the other officers said to me, "You know," he said, "we officers respected you very much when you refused to type that citation for," you see. And I said, "I didn't know anybody knew about it. Oh, it got round," he said.